A series of talks on complex manifolds. And there seem to be many possible different courses you could give on complex manifolds, so I'm going to give you my own biased way of thinking about things. And the plan of the course is going to be roughly as follows. I'll discuss the differential geometry aspects. First, but then I'm going to move on to aspects of algebraic geometry, which is where I want my focus to be. And I'll explain the connections between differential and algebraic geometry and the relative merits of each one. And here we're going to do some computations. In cohomology. Because I think this is the most general useful tool I could teach you for what gets used in subjects such as superstrings. The most difficult calculation you usually end up doing is the calculation in cohomology. And then that's probably all I'll have time for, but in case things go a little bit quicker than I expect, I might also add something on orbifolds or spectral sequences. We'll see how far we get. Okay, so that's the rough outline. As I said, I'm not exactly sure how far I'll get, but we will see. So let's first discuss differential geometry. So these are the two main tools in geometry, differential geometry and algebraic geometry. So let's first of all do a quick review of differential geometry. So this, of course, is where most physicists start thinking in geometry because you've been taught general relativity, so that's the way in which you always couch any question in terms of geometry. So this is familiar from general relativity. And the basic premise of differential geometry is that any manifold, well, in a sense, this is the definition of the word manifold, any manifold looks locally like some open subset of Rn. It looks like it's part of just flat, boring, n-dimensional real vector space. And then what you do after you've given your space or space-time structure manifold is to think in terms of a metric using local coordinates and the local coordinates you've been able to define from this first property that it looks locally like Rn. So you'll write something like ds squared equals g mu nu dx mu dx nu, and then to do calculations you'll start doing calculus with this metric so you can compute connections and curvatures. So this is what physicists call general relativity and what mathematicians call differential geometry. Now, if you need any more structure than just the manifold itself, the next ingredient that you normally add to differential geometry is the notion of a vector bundle. And obviously this crops up in physics all the time. So the idea of a vector bundle is that I have a map from some bigger space E to my manifold M. So E and M are manifolds. Such that if I take the inverse image under this map pi of any point inside X, it's isomorphic to r to the k for any x inside my manifold M. And if I was being rigorous, I'd make a couple more statements about pi, but I'll get to that when I get to the definition of a complex vector bundle. But let's just leave it at that for now. The condition I put on pi is that pi is a C infinity map. I can differentiate it an infinite number of times. It's a continuous map. And for every point inside M, there exists a, this symbol means there exists, by the way, if you haven't seen it, if I do a uppercase E backwards, it just means there exists an open neighborhood of x0 such that there's a map from pi inverse of that open neighborhood to the product of u times rk, such that this is a, well, I'll give it the right word, this is a diffeomorphism. All I mean by that is that it's an invertible differentiable map. So it basically means that that looks like that. This is in some way an equivalence between that and that. And then the transition functions that we had from the manifold structure here can be extended to transition functions in the vector bundle. So that was a lightning review, and I'll go through all this in much more detail when we talk about complex numbers, of the basic ideas we have in differential geometry. Now let me quickly do a lightning review. Let's see which blackboard eraser works best, I'm not sure which. Of what kind of stuff we do in algebraic geometry. I guess the other one's better. So what kind of stuff do we do in algebraic geometry is in contrast to differential geometry. Is the following. Oh, and I should have said, of course, that once you get to vector bundles, you can do exactly the same calculus as we did with the manifolds. I can put connections on bundles. I can compute their curvature. But I'm sure you've already seen all that. So in algebraic geometry, you approach the question differently. You don't begin with the assertion that you want to put some manifold-like structure on your space. I don't want to make it look locally like Rn. Instead, I'm going to think of my space as a graph. So e.g., a typical kind of thing you might say in algebraic geometry is, consider the equation y squared equals x cubed plus x squared. And this is a subspace of, say, R2, and I can sketch this graph, and of course it looks something like this. So somehow, I've encoded the sort of non-trivial geometry of this loop here into an equation. And I can play with this equation to try and understand the geometry of this, this shape, rather than using the sort of calculus-like tools that I'd use in differential geometry. So instead of calculus, you use properties of algebraic equations when you do algebraic geometry. And as we'll see, instead of vector bundles, we can put an equivalent structure. I can think of functions living on this line, and I'll be using the language of sheaves to replace the language of vector bundles that I use here. Okay, so the obvious question is, well, as physicists, we all know that general relativity is a good thing, and therefore differential geometry is natural. Why should we be bothered with algebraic geometry? And indeed, until string theory came along, people didn't discuss algebraic geometry and physics very much. So what's the connection of algebraic geometry to physics? Well, it's twofold. First of all, if you want to do a particular calculation in differential geometry, it often turns out that you can translate it into an equivalent problem in algebraic geometry, and the problem in algebraic geometry is easier to solve. So algebraic geometry is often equivalent to differential geometry. But easier to analyze. A problem in algebra is often easier than a problem in calculus. The second point, which has certainly cropped up since the geometry of string theory started to be better understood, it might, in some cases, better represent, now I have to put in quote, true physics. It might be that you actually get closer to what stringy geometry really is sometimes using the language of algebraic geometry rather than differential geometry. And in a sense, we should be worried that differential geometry is the right thing, because the very first premise of defining things in terms of manifolds is that space looks locally like Rn. Now, anybody who thinks about quantum gravity can't believe for a minute that space looks locally like Rn once you're down to very, very small scales. So we should be disturbed that differential geometry should be the absolute and final answer to everything in physics. And subjects such as mirror symmetry, where quite a lot of knowledge about stringy geometry has been found, is usually couched in terms of language in the language of algebraic geometry, because it's more applicable to the situation than differential geometry is. So that's the good thing about algebraic geometry. So why don't we all sort of give up any pretensions to differential geometry and just all work on algebraic geometry? Well, it has its disadvantages. And the biggest disadvantage is that algebraic geometry is only easy if we work over, well, easy, I guess, is a relative term, but it's certainly downside easier if we work over what you call an algebraically closed field. And what this means is that if we try and work over the real numbers, if I try and do a problem like I sketched, where I sketched some graph in R2, and I think of it as a one real dimensional subspace of R2, it turns out that algebraic geometry is pretty difficult if you work over the real numbers, because the real numbers do not constitute an algebraically closed field. I can't solve the equation x squared equals minus 1 over the real numbers. But of course, the complex numbers are an algebraically good, are an algebraically closed field. And it turns out if you work over the complex numbers, then life is a lot more simple. So algebraic geometry is only really useful if the problem you're working on is naturally defined over the complex numbers rather than the real numbers. And that's why it's only in the context of complex manifolds that you can use the tools that I'll be discussing. Now, the main reason this complex numbers crop up so much when we do work on subjects such as strings is because of the appearance of supersymmetry. Anytime you analyze supersymmetry, complex numbers are always lurking around somewhere. Things tend to be holomorphic and things like that when working in supersymmetry. So it's because of supersymmetry, the prevalence of supersymmetry in modern string theory, that we end up trying to solve problems in algebraic geometry precisely because we're working over the complex numbers. So you might worry that if there really is no supersymmetry, then everything I'm going to tell you is completely useless. And that might well be the case. But obviously, we all hope it's not. Okay, so that was my little pep talk on why we should want to learn something about algebraic geometry. So before I actually discuss complex algebraic geometry, let's discuss complex differential geometry first to get our groundings in a language that's more familiar to most of you. So let's consider the differential geometry of complex manifolds. So hopefully what I'm going to say is going to be familiar to most of you, except that I'm going to be using complex numbers rather than real numbers. So first of all, my definition of a complex manifold. A complex manifold of complex dimension n is a manifold. So it's a manifold in the usual sense, with an open cover U alpha. So every one of my U alphas is some open subset inside my complex manifold. Oops, I'm going to call it M, by the way. And if I take the union of all those open subsets, then it is the whole complex manifold M. And coordinate maps phi alpha U alpha into Cn. So I map all my open subsets into Cn. Use the other one. So it's just the same as a real manifold, except the only thing I'm going to impose is that the transition functions, if I take phi alpha, or if I take phi beta inverse composed of phi alpha, this must be holomorphic on the intersection. And where, of course, by holomorphic, I mean that it's a function of the zj's. So my local coordinates on Cn, I'm always going to use lowercase z for. It's a function of the zj's and not zj bars. So it's just like a real manifold, except I'm using complex numbers rather than real numbers, and my transition functions are holomorphic rather than C infinity. Sorry? Yes. Yeah, I mean, this is a diffeomorphism over the image of phi alpha, so you've got to make sure that you're evaluating these in the right place. Yeah, so to be precise, I should have put phi, yeah. I guess this is what you're complaining about. I said it's that's right. That's where it should be. Okay, so So obviously, a complex manifold is a real manifold. If I take my complex coordinates, zj, and I write it as xj plus iyj, where x and y's are coordinates on Rn, then this complex manifold is a real manifold of dimension, of real dimension 2n. So that's an obvious statement. So let's give some examples of complex manifolds. Well, of course, the first obvious example of a complex manifold is Cn. That's the trivial example. And the other example, which is the example that really matters, it's going to be the mother of all examples, is the complex projective space that I'll call Pn. This is also known as CPn, if you want to emphasize it's the field of complex numbers you're working over, but we're always going to be working over the complex numbers, so I'll just call it Pn. So to define CPn, as you've probably all seen, you take C to the n plus 1, I take n plus 1 dimensional complex space, and I have homogeneous coordinates that I'll use uppercase Z4. So I have n plus 1 coordinates on C n plus 1, and I identify a point in C n plus 1 with this set of coordinates to a point in Cn plus 1 with this, with these coordinates. So this is Cn plus 1, and I subtract out the origin to make it a nice, smooth, well-defined quotient. So identify all these points with all these points in Cn plus 1, and that gives where lambda is any complex number. Obviously, we may as well make it non-zero since we're not including the origin anyway, in Cn plus 1. So this is an n-dimensional complex manifold if I make this identification. And to prove that, let me give you the open sets, U alpha, the patches on this space that give it the structure of a complex manifold. So to see this is a complex manifold, put open set UK equal to PN minus all the points with the kth homogeneous coordinate equal to zero. So that's going to be my open set. And I've got n plus one of them because k can run from zero to n. And my map into Cn is going to be defined as follows. So phi j acting on uj is given by so if you give me a point with a bunch of homogeneous coordinates, then this is simply equal to Z0 divided by ZK, z1 divided by zk. So I divide all the coordinates by the kth homogeneous coordinate, which I can do because I've insisted that the kth homogeneous coordinate is non-zero. Pardon? Yeah, I've said that my patch here, I've subtracted away all the points which have got zk as zero. So my zk is definitely non-zero in this patch. And then I omit, this little hat here means omit the kth coordinate here. So indeed, I just have n numbers here, because I had n plus 1 homogeneous coordinates. I have n numbers here, and those n numbers represent my point in Cn. So I've explicitly given a map from this open set, UK, into Cn by omitting the kth coordinates and dividing out by zk on all the other coordinates. And obviously, it's a well-defined map, because when I do this rescaling by lambda, it cancels out. So this is a well-defined map from any point with these homogeneous coordinates to that point with coordinates in Cn. And then it's a simple matter to work out the transition functions. If this is the definition of phi, then it's easy to prove that if I want to use this, so I'm going to use lowercase z for coordinates on Cn. My lowercase z's are the coordinates. And, well, for the usual covariance and contravariant reason, if I remember, I'll use superscripts for these coordinates. So it's easy to work out that the transition function applied to this is so we omit the jth entry, and then we have a 1, that's the number 1, divided by zj up to zn, divided by zj, where this is the kth position. So that indeed is a holomorphic map from Cn to Cn, so it satisfies my condition for a complex manifold. Okay, so that's the definition of a complex manifold, and Pn or CPn is going to be our canonical non-trivial example. Well, I have n numbers here, and I have n numbers here, hopefully, if I've done it right, because because I'm going from 1, 2 up to n. I've got rid of the jth coordinate, and I've inserted one more guy in the kth position. So indeed, there are n numbers here. Okay, so that's our complex manifold. Now let's do a complex vector bundle. And I can define a complex vector bundle over any manifold. I don't need the manifold that I'm over itself to be complex. So let's first define a complex vector bundle over a real manifold. So it's just like a vector bundle over, it's just like a a real vector bundle at first. So this is, so I have a map E to M. E and M are manifolds. Not necessarily complex. Pi is a infinitely differentiable map. Now I impose further conditions as follows. So such that. So the first condition I'm going to impose is that pi inverse of any point is equal to ck, is diffeomorphic to ck for all x in M. So I've just replaced rk by c to the k. Then I have my next condition, which again is very similar to the real case. There exists an open neighborhood U of any x. I call it x0, I call it x this time. With a map, phi inverse of U goes to, let's call this phi subscript U, goes to the product U times CK. And this again is a C infinity diffeomorphism. It's an invertible, infinitely differentiable map. And then let me put a couple of conditions on this map. I should say, by the way, that I copied this definition out of Griffiths and Harris, which I should have said at the start that Griffiths and Harris, the Principles of Algebraic Geometry, Chapter 0, is a pretty good reference for some of the stuff I'll be talking about. But I'm not very satisfied with their definition of this. I think it has a slight hole in it. So let me add a couple more statements which make it more solid. So I'm going to impose a couple of conditions on this map. I want that pi composed with phi inverse x v equals x for all v in c k, and if I map v to phi u inverse x v, for a fixed x in M yields an isomorphism. So these are a couple of technical conditions which, unless you're a pedant, you shouldn't really worry about, but I'm going to put them up for completeness. There's a couple of natural conditions to put on this trivialization map phi. So I said, don't worry too much about these, but if anybody was going to give me a hard time, I thought I should put those up. So that's some natural conditions to put on this trivialization map phi u. And that's my definition of a complex vector bundle. So it looks very similar to the real vector bundle, but I've just got complex numbers rather than real numbers. So k is the rank of the bundle. Often called the dimension of the bundle. And k is 1 is called a complex line bundle. Now, one nice way of describing the data involved in the definition of a complex vector bundle is to use the language of transition functions as follows. So if U and V are open sets, with trivialization phi u and phi v as above, then you can compose them I can compose the inverse of phi v with phi u, and this defines transition functions. And this is the way that you'll usually present the definition of a particular complex vector bundle. And of course, the transition functions are g of uv defined on u intersection v. Well, I guess properly speaking, it's defined on phi v of u intersection v. Well, let me not clutter my notation with that. It defines a map of that into gl KC, where this is a differentiable map. And this of course just means that I have a K by K matrix of functions where the matrix is always invertible. So this matrix defines precisely my transitions from the different patches in this complex vector bundle. Okay. And clearly, if I use the transition functions to go from patch U to patch V, from patch V to patch U, and then I compose that with the transition functions from patch U to patch V, then I get back to where I started with. So that's the identity matrix. And also, if I go from V to U, and then I go from W, if I go from U to W, then I go from W to V, then I go from V to U, I again get back to where I started. So my transition functions obviously satisfy these two conditions, and I'll call star. No, it's a map from CK to CK. Right, so GUV on a point is going to be an element of this matrix group. Yeah, well, as I said, I was being a bit sloppy with the notation here. This should probably be 5V. I should probably insert 5Vs, which is going to make the notation a bit nasty. So I was hoping that the meaning is fairly transparent of this. No, it's not. It's a map from CK to CK. It is an element of GLKC. Right. So I'm composing three maps from CK to CK. Okay. Okay, so given a complex vector bundle, we can find these transition functions which satisfy these two conditions. But often, the converse statement is actually more useful. Conversely, given an open cover, U alpha of M, and C infinity maps, GUV, satisfying star. So if I give you the transition functions and the transition functions satisfy these two conditions, then there exists a unique. Oops, bad luck with this chalk. So press a little bit more gently. Then there exists. Satisfying. Oh, then there exists a unique. Well, unique up to change of coordinates in an obvious way. Complex vector bundle with these transition functions. So often it's just easier to define what the complex vector bundle is just in terms of transition functions rather than the trivialization maps. Okay. So I'll give you an example of a complex vector bundle in a minute, but let me just make a few more general statements. So given a complex vector bundle E over M, then I can take the transition functions that I have for that complex vector bundle, and by changing the transition functions, I can make some new complex vector bundles. And one thing I can do is I can take the transition functions I had and take the transpose of the inverse, which I'll denote like that, and use the transpose of the inverse as the new transition functions. They're definitely invertible because it's in GLKC. And this defines a what's called the dual bundle. So for every vector bundle, I can construct the dual bundle. And it's either denoted E star or sometimes E little V on top. So every vector bundle has a dual. Similarly, if you give me two bundles, I can combine them. I can take the Whitney sum, or the direct sum of those two bundles. And to do that, my new matrices, I just make them block diagonal matrices for my transition functions. And I have the transition functions for E on the top left and the transition functions for F on the bottom right, and zeros elsewhere. So these are my transition functions for F. So that's just the sum of two bundles. And of course, the dimensions add. Well, the ranks add for this sum of bundles. And I can take a product as well. So I can also take the tensor product. And now I just multiply the transition functions. This, I guess, is what in linear algebra you call the outer products. The dimensions of the matrices are multiplying now. The rank of this bundle is the rank of that times the rank of that. And notice in particular, if these are both line bundles, if E is a line bundle and F is a line bundle, I get a line bundle back. I simply multiply these one-by-one matrices together to get another one-by-one matrix in the case of line bundles. So this is particularly useful for line bundles. I multiply two line bundles together and I get another line bundle. And once I've defined what I mean by tensor multiplication, then I can define the things like symmetric and exterior powers. So a kth, well, I've already used kth, m e is the anti-symmetrization of E tensor E. So I just use my usual definition of anti-symmetrization to define the exterior powers of vector bundles. Okay, so that's just one way of making new vector bundles from smaller ones. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I've got a fixed base manifold M. Yeah, that's a good point. Should have stated that. So one more thing to define. A global section is a map, again, a C infinity map, like every map that we've mentioned so far. E. So I've got my my bundle map pi, which projects me down from the big bundle space E to my manifold M. Sigma is a map going the other way. My section, if it's a right inverse of pi. So sigma composed of pi equals the identity. So if I have a map from M back into E, then that's called a section. And obviously what you're doing with a section is for every fiber, for every CK fiber, you're picking a point. So I pick one point in every fiber in a nice smooth way, and that defines a section. So that's a global section because it's defined for all of M. I can also define local sections. And the idea of a local section is going to be quite important. And it's the same thing, but I just define it on a subset of M, probably an open subset most of the time. Okay, so that's a global section and a local section. Now, so far we've taken the case where the base space M is a general real manifold. Now, of course, we're more interested in the case where it's a complex manifold. And if the base manifold is complex, then there's an obvious further condition we can put on our complex vector bundle. And this is where we call it a holomorphic vector bundle. So if M is a complex manifold, and the transition functions so I've got my k by k matrix of functions. The obvious thing to impose is the fact that those functions are all holomorphic functions. These are functions of the coordinates of the base manifold, but if we have a complex manifold, then our base manifold has got complex coordinates. So we've got complex functions of complex coordinates. Let's impose that they're holomorphic functions. So if M is a complex manifold and the transition functions G are holomorphic, then our vector bundle E is said to be holomorphic. So you can have complex vector bundles over a complex manifold which are not holomorphic, and you can have ones which are holomorphic. And the way I define sections here, I can obviously now also demand that these sections could be holomorphic sections. If this map sigma is a holomorphic map from M into E, which is a right inverse of pi, then sigma is said to be a holomorphic section. So similarly, I define holomorphic sections. Holomorphic sections. Okay, so let's give the standard example of a holomorphic vector bundle over a complex manifold. So let's consider tangent bundles. So let's just remind ourselves of the real case first. So the way you define the real tangent bundle for a real manifold is by taking the space of directional derivatives. So I'm taking the standard approach. I think Wald explains this very well, for example, the definition of the tangent bundle. So a directional derivative can always be written as sort of V mu dx by dx mu, or some tangent vector V mu. So the basis of this of the fiber, the basis of the vector space that looks like Rn, which is the fiber that I associate to every point, the basis of Rn for each x and m is simply these symbols dx. So that's like a basis vector in the fiber Rn over every point. And once I've told you that that's what the basis vectors are, then of course it's a simple matter to work out what the transition functions are. Because if you tell me what the transition functions of the complex manifold are, then I can simply use calculus to find out what the relationship between the d by dx mu's are between different patches. And that tells me exactly what the transition functions on the vector bundle is. So that defines the tangent bundle, which I hope you've all seen. But now let's try and do things over the complex numbers. Well, the first thing to say is that if we have a complex manifold, of complex dimension, let me explicitly say complex dimension because this is often a confusing point of counting factors of two. Let's suppose I have a complex dimension n. Then, as I said before, any complex manifold is a real manifold, so I can just use the usual definition of the real tangent bundle to define a tangent bundle on this complex manifold. So this is a tangent bundle on my complex manifold. So d by dx j and d by dy j form a basis for the fiber r to the 2n, because j goes from 1 to n, so I have 2n of these things. For a vector bundle. And this, of course, is precisely the same vector bundle that I had here. It's just that my manifold happens to be complex, but I can think of it as a real manifold, and I can construct a vector bundle. And the vector bundle has got basis elements this for the vector space over every point. So that's kind of a trivial way of putting a tangent bundle on a complex vector bundle. Just give me the real tangent space that I already know about. Well, the next thing I could do is I could just use this as a basis for complex vector spaces rather than real vector spaces. So define TC, and this is called the complexified tangent bundle, to be the complex vector bundle with a basis, with exactly the same basis. Oh, superscript. So my fiber here was r to the 2n. My fiber here is c to the 2n, because I'm just replacing my real vector space with a complex vector space. So I have a complex vector bundle of rank 2n, which is my complexified tangent bundle. All I've done is I've taken the real tangent bundle and just complexified it. I've turned real numbers into complex numbers. So it's a rather trivial thing to do, but it's the obvious way of defining a complex vector bundle from the tangent bundle. Just use complex numbers rather than real numbers. So as a complex vector bundle, this is rank 2n. As a real vector bundle, this is rank 4n. Okay. So that's the complexified tangent bundle. But it's not yet the most obvious tangent bundle to use. So let's think about this tangent bundle a little bit more. Well, if if these things are basis elements, well, of course, z is just x plus iy. So any function of x and y, I can also rewrite as a function of z and z bar. So I can equally use z and z bar as a basis rather than x and y. So I can write things in terms of my complex coordinates z and z bar. And that equally defines the complexified tangent bundle. But if the manifold is a complex manifold, then we know that the transition functions are holomorphic functions. So if I have holomorphic transition functions on the manifold, on the coordinate patches in the manifold, then when I work out the transition functions for this bundle, when I compute what d by dz bar is for one patch in terms of dz by dz bar for another patch, as it's a holomorphic function, the d by dz's on one patch are just going to be functions of d by dz's on the other patches, and d by dz bars on one patch are going to be functions of d by dz bars on the other patches. The z's and the z bars are not going to mix. So when I try and work out what this tangent bundle is, all my transition functions are going to be of a block diagonal form. I'm going to get the z coordinate parts are not going to talk to the z bar coordinate parts. So let me say that again. If the manifold has holomorphic transition functions, then by dzj in one patch is only a function of d by dz. We call it primes. I mean, I'm mixing my notation up here, but let's say that z is a coordinate on one patch and z prime is a coordinate on another patch. So the z is a function of z primes. So the d by dz is just going to be a function of d by dz primes. So in other words, we've got a block diagonal form for the transition functions. Which means if we go back to our definition of the direct sum for two bundles, then it means that TC is actually the sum of two bundles. There's the part that was to do with Z, and the part that was to do with Z bar. It naturally splits into a direct sum of two bundles, where this is exactly the same as that, except I've replaced the Z's by Z bars. So this, in a sense, is exactly the complex conjugate of that. So we've defined a complexified tangent bundle, which is of dimension 2n, just by complexifying the real tangent bundle. But on a complex manifold, this naturally decomposes. It falls apart into a sum of two vector bundles, each of complex rank n, one of which is the complex conjugate of the other. So this one we call the holomorphic tangent bundle. And of course, that one you call the anti-holomorphic tangent bundle. So that's the definition of the holomorphic tangent bundle. It's the sort of canonical bundle that any complex manifold comes with. And we had to do a bit of a dance with complexifying it and then breaking it up into two parts, but it's got a natural definition. It's exactly the bundle that you would define from the transition functions where I take d by dz as a basis in each of my fibers. Okay. So any questions on holomorphic tangent bundle? Okay. Well, it's very easy to define the dual of the tangent bundle. All we do for the dual is that rather than writing things in terms of d by dz, we write things in terms of differentials dz. So we may also define the dual of tangent bundles. Let me say tangent bundles, because it applies equally to all of the bundles I've been writing down, whether it be the real tangent bundle, the complexified tangent bundle, or the holomorphic tangent bundle. By using dxi, dxj, etc. And this, of course, is called the cotangent bundle. And is written T star. So there's a real cotangent bundle, there's a complexified cotangent bundle, and there's a holomorphic cotangent bundle. Well, once I've got a cotangent bundle, then the next thing any decent book on differential geometry does is talk about differential forms. So let's ask what differential forms look like on our complex manifold. Well, of course, what we do for differential forms is we start taking exterior powers of the cotangent bundle. So I've got TC equals T plus T bar. So if I take some exterior powers of this, let's say I take the, use N here, let me use K. Hopefully my notation won't be in that. Let's do the cotangent bundle. Splits in the same way. let's take the kth exterior power of that. Well, I hope it's clear from linear algebra that the following is then true. If I take the kth exterior power of a direct sum, then it's got to split in this way. It's a bit of linear algebra of exterior powers. So this vector bundle here must split into a sum of vector bundles, each of which is a product of exterior powers of the holomorphic cotangent bundle with exterior powers of the anti-holomorphic cotangent bundle. And if I look at C infinity sections of these bundles, so a global C infinity section of the kth exterior power of the cotangent bundle is what's known as a k-form. Well, to be precise, it's a complexified k-form, because I've taken the complexified cotangent bundle. And of course, a complexified k-form is just like a real k-form, but the functions I can use in defining the form can be complex numbers, complex valued. Okay, so a global C infinity section of this is called a k-form, and a global C infinity section of this is called a PQ-form. So it's got P holomorphic parts and Q anti-holomorphic parts. So that's the definition of PQ-forms. So notice, this is a C infinity section. It's not a holomorphic section. It's just that any continuous section of this, any global section of this is called a PQ form. Right, there's no relation between the P indices and the Q indices. Okay, so now I've defined P and Q forms, K forms and PQ forms. The next thing you do is you define cohomology based on differential forms. So let APQ of M be the space of C infinity sections, C infinity global sections of what we already said, T bar, star. And then define some differential operators. Round D goes from APQ to AP plus 1 Q. And round D bar goes from APQ to AP Q plus 1 in the obvious way. And by the obvious way, I mean D of. So if you give me a differential form, so J, K, I hope I'm not writing too small for the back. I'll try and make it as big as I can. Sorry? Okay, I'll try and make my subscripts a little bit oversized. So of course, any differential form you can write in terms of our basis differentials, I can do a, I can, it's written as a function times the basis elements dz j dz k. So that's my general differential form. And well, I'm going to have some dz bars as well here, of course. For some reason, it's standard when you do dz bar to put a bar over the superscript and not the z itself. I have no idea why, but this is the standard notation. So that's like dz bar l bar, but you just put dz l bar. So d of that would be defined as the sum over s j k etc. of d a j k etc. d by dz s, and then the same things with perhaps some anti-holomorphic guys there as well. So that's exactly the same definition as you have for the usual Durham differential d, but I'm just differentiating with respect to the holomorphic coordinates in the case of d, and in the case of d bar you just differentiate with respect to the anti-holomorphic coordinates. Yes, you're absolutely right. The first one should have been a dzs. Yeah, thanks. Well, there's an obvious relation between the usual Durham D and these Ds and D bars. And it's easy to prove that D equals D plus D bar, where D is the usual Durham differential. And then once we've defined the differentials, we define cohomology in the usual way. So of course, the definition of Durham cohomology K. Perhaps I'll put a subscript dr. I'm never sure if Durham use an uppercase d or not, so I vary. This is the kernel of d divided by the image of d in the usual way. I'm kind of assuming that everybody's already seen Durham cohomology. And the nth Betti number is simply the dimension of this group. Ah, BK. So that's the kth Betti number. Well, once you've defined that, then you can define something very similar for these complex differential forms. And this is called Dolbeau cohomology. Where I use the round D operator instead of the Durham operator. So HPQ is simply the kernel of D on. This is obviously, by the way, the kernel of this applied to, what do I call it? Let me do it here. I'm bogging myself down in notation. Obviously, on APQ, it's the kernel of that divided by the image of D bar on APQ minus 1. So this is the space of all PQ forms which are killed by d bar, on which d bar maps to 0, but I divide out by the space of all pq forms, which are d bar of some pq minus 1 form. Okay. And that's the definition of Dolbeau cohomology. And hpq is defined as the dimension of this cohomology group. So these BKs are called Betty numbers. And these HPQs are called Hodge numbers. And what we're going to do, what the aim of this course is going to be, at least in part, is to calculate some of these Hodge numbers in some highly non-trivial example. Because they crop up a lot in string theory. Well, I didn't define that. So let's say that my complex is kind of AP, let's say AK goes to AK plus 1. So let's say that AK is the space of all K forms. So this would be the kernel of D on AK divided by the image of D on AK minus 1. So it's all forms which are killed by D, i.e. closed forms, divided by all forms which are D of something, i.e. Cycles. Sorry. It's cycles divided. Let me say that again. It's all forms which are killed by D, which are called co-cycles, divided by all things which are image of D, which are called co-boundaries. Okay. So any question on that? I said I'm kind of hoping that everybody's kind of familiar with Durham cohomology in some form or another. So let me probably close with another example of a complex vector bundle, which is also going to prove extremely useful. Indeed, in a way, this is the only vector bundle you ever need to know about. You can build everything from this. That's a good question. It's whatever is the natural thing that you're working over. So here, I guess, is complex dimension. Well, yeah, I mean, I haven't summed the Hodge numbers yet, but when I say dimension, it's in this case, it's whatever you were working over with. So if I was doing real p-forms, then I'd want the real dimension, or if I was doing complex p-forms, I'd want the complex dimension. And it's the same number. So it's the dimension over whichever field you happen to be working with at that point. But here it has to be complex numbers only. So let's do the the only vector bundle that matters, in a sense. We can build everything from this. Let's consider line bundles on complex projective space Pn. And I claim, in a sense, they're going to be classified by the integers. So I'm going to call the following Lm. So I pick an integer m, and I define a line bundle on Pn as follows. So recall uj is the patch with zj is 0. So uj is a set of all points such that the jth homogeneous coordinate is 0. And then suppose and suppose I define the bundle in terms of transition functions as follows. And I hope I haven't got this backwards. There's a 50-50 chance I got this backwards or not. I tried my best, but there's so many points where you can go wrong that there's a 50-50 chance I've got this right. Suppose the transition function is given by zj divided by zk to the power m multiplied by. So what I mean is that so this is a line bundle. So all I need to give you is a one-by-one matrix, namely a function, I just need to give you a transition function, and my transition function is going to be this. So if you give me a vector, i.e. a number, because it's just a one-dimensional vector, if you give me a complex number that represents some point in a fiber C over one thing, then you just multiply it by this to get the fiber in the other thing. So this is my GL1C transition function for this line bundle. And if I got it right, then it's this. And if I got it wrong, that should be minus M. But that's what my definition of my line bundle is going to be. So as I said, if I give you the transition function, then I've given you the line bundle. So this fully defines a line bundle. In fact, an infinite class of line bundles, because M can be any integer. Obviously, it can't be a non-integer, because then I wouldn't have a holomorphic transition function. It'd be a branch cut. But if M is any positive or negative or zero integer, I have a line bundle. So let's think what this line bundle looks like. So let's do an example, e.g., obviously L0 is completely trivial. That's the trivial line bundle where the bundle itself just breaks up into a product of CPN. So L0 is simply PN times C. This is the trivial line bundle. And now let's look at L1 on P1. Let's think about L1 on P1. So consider a global section. Let's think what a global section of this line bundle looks like. As we'll see later in gory details, you know a lot about bundles if you know about their sections. So the first thing, if you want to know something about a bundle, the first thing you can ask about is what the global sections look like. So let's think what the global sections of L1 look like. And suppose we have a global section which looks like 1 in U0. So my fiber that looks like C over U0, I'm going to just say that the base maps to the number 1 over the whole of U0. So it's a constant section over U0. Then in U1, this section looks like, well, I use my transition function to find out what the section looks like in the other patch. And my rule is that I multiply by this ratio of the homogeneous coordinates. Section one that looks like 1 times Z0 divided by Z1. So it's the constant number 1 in U0, but in U1 it looks like Z0 divided by U1, by Z0 divided by Z1. Well, that's quite nice because I know that Z1, the homogeneous coordinate Z1 is never zero in U1. So this never goes off to infinity. It's always a finite number. But it does go to zero because Z0 can be zero in U1. There's exactly one point in U1 where Z0 is zero. So this global section is never infinite. But it has 1, 0 at Z0 is 0. So CP1, which of course looks like a two-sphere, this section is kind of it's non-zero everywhere except at one point where it's zero. So that's what a global section of this line bundle looks like. Now, of course, what I gave you here was an example of a global section. I said, suppose the global section looks like one in that patch, then it's forced to look like this in the other patch. You could think of other things, but actually, it turns out that if you always insist that the global section is never infinite, if it's finite everywhere, then it must always be zero at exactly one point. That's a general property of this bundle. And indeed, that one is precisely because m was equal to one. So a global section of Lm has m zeros . This other Dan Quayle moment. I'm not sure if zeros has got an E in it, but that may or may not be the right spelling. Well, of course, what I mean by this is, generically, there are going to be m points where that global section is going to be zero. If you pick special cases, some of those m points might merge, so there might be fewer than m points, but generically, there are going to be m zeros. Which means, of course, that if m is negative, if m is less than zero, then there are no global sections which are always finite. Okay. And of course, the case L0, which is the product, we can never have any zeros, and that's the standard statement that a holomorphic function on a complex manifold can can never have any zeros. It must be a constant. So that's the statement in L0, is we'd have zero zeros in that case. Right, so, well, in general, if you're allowed poles, then this number here is going to be the number of zeros minus the number of poles. Okay. So yes, in general, if m is negative and you allow for no zeros, then there must be minus m poles. Well, I think that's a very convenient place to stop. So next time we'll go on to almost complex structures, and we'll get on to some other topics in algebraic geometry. So thanks, I'll stop there.